This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. Value Hive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive. 9 p.m. my time and 9 a.m. Singapore time for my guest, which is Kelvin Seto. You might know him as Slingshot Capital on Twitter. And Kelvin's got some really interesting background just on how he invests and where he invests and unique perspectives on Asian investments and kind of the esoteric differences between Asian companies and U.S. companies that U.S. investors might not fully understand. And he's got some really interesting ideas that we're going to chat about, and also just kind of his philosophy on investing, talk about emerging moats, and really anything else that comes up on this late night session. So I think this might be the latest I've recorded a podcast, but I'm super excited. And it's you know, early morning for Kelvin. He's probably had some breakfast. I'm winding down with some tea. So let's dive into this, Kelvin. So who is Kelvin? Who is Slingshot Capital? How do you wind up on Twitter? And, you know, talk to us maybe about why you chose that name.
All right. So, hey, Brendan, you know, it's really an honor to be on your podcast. You know, your podcast has done a lot of great value. I think I'm also a listener. So thanks for having me. So this question is really great, right? Like, who's Slingshot Capital? So I guess I'll just give a very quick run through about my life story. I think growing up in Singapore, there were certain occasions where I felt financially quite inferior, and that got me thinking about how do I make money in this life, you know, especially as young as 18, 19, I was just thinking about money back then. So for me, it was a point where, you know, I started a business school, and I always wanted to be the top, right? And, throughout certain semesters, I realized that, hey, you know, there's this friend of mine who is always top in class. And then I got a bit frustrated. So I actually asked my lecturer, hey, Mr. Daniel, how can I actually be the best at what I do? And he said something very simple. Hey, Kelvin, you got to pick unfair fights. So what I mean by that, that means if everyone is starting and they are doing really well and you are playing a game that you somehow you can't seem to win, why don't choose a different game, which is investing? He handed me a book called One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. And, you know, that got me started in investing. But I think what really propelled me and gave me the success when I was really young is really putting my best work out there. So I was writing blogs, I was contributing to a lot of forums, and I was paying money for people to have meals with me. And I grew a lot through that process. And so in Singapore, we have something called the National Service, where every eligible male has to serve the country, something similar to the Israel as well. So I think at the point, I was still blogging a lot. And I think one of the listed company CEO saw my article and invited me to join him. So in Singapore, we have something called the polytechnic. So I finished my polytechnic studies and I'm supposed to go university on a government scholarship. But I felt that, the opportunity given to me was too good to be missed. I gave up my government scholarship. I gave up my university placement and I joined him. I worked there for about 3 years and, you know, life was good in a way that my boss was very harsh. But that gave me a lot of experiences. I grew a lot. We were calling management teams from Korea, Japan, neighboring Asian countries as well, and a little bit of Australia as well. But to some point, I realized that making money was kind of not the purpose of my life anymore, because I wanted to really see life differently. So with some of my portfolio that have grown to a certain size, I decided to travel around the world, finally for the first time in many, many years. And from there, I really discovered that, hey, you know, the life is really worthwhile living. And I thought that, you know, this kind of life for me back then as a 22 years old was abnormal, right? And I felt like I had the luxury to do that. And I wanted to say, hey, you know, how could I actually pass on this ability to other people? And which is why in Singapore, when I came back, I started an education company whereby I really condensed what I've learned working for different fund managers and pass it down to people as well. But from then on, I realized that while I tried my best to educate people, but not everyone wants to be educated, or sometimes they don't have the time as well, because taking care of kids, juggling work, that's not easy at all. And this is the reason why I started a managed account services in Singapore, and I name it as Slingshot Fund. It's a reference to David and Goliath as well. With a single slingshot, you know, you could actually create a huge impact to the world as well. So that's how the name came about, and I'm really grateful for the opportunities that I have since I was young. And you know, being on Twitter, that's another great point. And my aim is just simply to contribute as much as I can, because I believe that as I contribute, I attract the right people into my life. And I really want to design an environment whereby I really work with people I admire and I respect the most.
So you mentioned that you were working for this guy, calling a bunch of management teams, doing all this work. Was there at a time before you said, you know what, I'm gonna stop and I'm gonna travel, you know, once my portfolio gets enough size? Were you ever burnt out from a physical, mental standpoint? And the only reason I ask that is, around Twitter, there was a lot of interesting feedback going on between like the Goldman Sachs analysts, where they did that interview, and you know how all of them were basically complaining about how they got 3 hours of sleep and stuff like that. And it's like, on one hand, I get it, but on the other hand, you're getting paid a lot of money and you kind of know what you're getting into. Did you ever feel that burnout while you were working those kind of first couple of years?
I would say that probably because I was still young and I had a lot of energy going for me, and I was the youngest member on the team, but yet I was given a lot of responsibilities, and I often consider myself very privileged to be working with the team, and which is why, you know, I try to be a sponge. I try to absorb as much as I can. Being burnt out, sure, yes, but I'm really very motivated to succeed well in this life, and I wanted to be the best that I could possibly be, right? And this is the reason why you know, sometimes when we are about to knock off, let's say 5 p.m., 6 p.m, my boss would hand me another company and say, hey, you know, Calvin, could you take a look at it, and could you get back to me by 9 p.m? What do you think of this company, right? Could you do a report? And I'm like, like, this is Friday, right? But then yeah. To me, I realized who has such opportunities when they were young. And when you put that into the perspective, you know, life isn't that bad. Life is interesting, because you know, I learned about this philosophy, right? What's the reward for doing a great job? Well, the answer is very simple: more work, because you are trustable, you are credible, and you are dependable, and that's why work goes to you, right?
Yeah.
So I started to see things differently, and from there I started to appreciate my boss a lot more, because he really trusts me in managing a lot of aspects of the fund. So being burnt out, yes, but I feel more grateful than anything. So I don't think every people would think like me, but of course there are, to be really honest, there are moments where I felt really down. I really needed some you know, rest. So I think being aware about our emotional state is really important to really succeed well in this business that we do.
Yeah, especially because, like, for myself, and I'm sure for you, this kind of rings true as well. It's a passion that you love. And so sometimes it doesn't feel like work, but that's also a double-edged sword, because you can get caught up spending hours and hours and hours and days working on stuff and neglect other things. And to you, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal, right? Because it's your passion, you love doing it. It's not like you're clocking in and clocking out. So it's always interesting to talk about that, you know, to someone that experienced something like that, that grueling mindset and those long hours, because, you know, you did enjoy it also, which is important in all this.
Yeah, so I just want to add on a little bit. I think there's a difference between a job and a career. I think a job belongs to the company, but a career belongs to yourself. So at the end of the day, while, you know, being an employee, I'm contributing directly to the company, but for me, the skill sets, the knowledge, the networks that I have belongs to me, and it stays with me forever. So in a way, I felt like, you know, I was also working for myself indirectly. And I think that's the best thing that I can do for myself, you know, to really want to learn more so that I can contribute more back to my friends around me.
So what kind of ideas, investments were you looking at at that time? And was this the point where you were starting to formulate your own investment philosophy? And maybe walk us through that journey between how you learned about your initial investment philosophy and then some lessons you took from that experience, both A, what you liked about it, and then B, maybe what you realized you didn't want for, you know, your future managed accounts.
Yeah, sure. So that's really an excellent question. I would say a lot of my philosophy framework today has been developed when I was working with my boss. So I just want to give a shout out to him. His name is Kee Koon Boon, a very well-known fund manager in Singapore. Okay, so I think when I joined the team, it was really clear to the whole investment team that, you know, if we were ever to, you know, spend our hours or our effort into any company, then we have to ask ourselves, can this company at least double up or triple up in terms of share price appreciation, maybe in the span of 5 years, right? If it doesn't, then, you know, why are we spending time with the company? So that really got us thinking a lot, because, you know, at the end of the day, I think one of the things that I remember is really what's our returns on our time spent. So from there, you know, we back then in the fund, we were looking for a compounders in Asia. But I don't think we are just focused on looking at a quantitative, because at the end of the day, if you have a capital IQ, you do a plugins, you know, you get the numbers, right? And that's not really a lot of meaning behind it. So I guess later on, I want to share a little bit about the concept of emerging modes. So for us, we spend a great deal of our time understanding the management teams. And for us, we studied over like 300 to 400 management teams of different listed companies. And we kind of draw out certain timeline of how they perhaps turn around a company, how do they create value. We draw out certain pattern recognitions, and we created a document that we called up our own. So we are looking for traits of a great management, right? So we look for things like skin in the game. We look for things like ability to execute, whether the management have the capability, have the experience, have the relevant team members as well. Does he build a strong team around him? Who are the board of directors? We look for the purpose. I think today, if you look at Elon Musk, who have built Tesla or SpaceX, or if you look at Steve Bezos, who have built Amazon, was it because they wanted to make money? I doubt so. You know, I really believe they want to create a company because they wanted to deliver better value to the world, right? Amazon isn't selling just normal products. They're selling this concept called convenience. Costco is not selling your normal groceries. They're selling value for money. It's a concept that they're selling. So we're actually looking for management teams that go beyond just the monetary aspects of the business, but really looking at how they can truly serve value to the masses. So from there, we have drawn certain traits that we want, such as we don't invest in ordinary hired management. We look for visionaries. We try to think about management teams that are often very frustrated at a certain problems, and they want to solve it, and they're just obsessed over it. And sometimes we do call out with the employees to understand, hey, you know, does your boss actually works overtime, you know, things like that, right? We really go on the ground to really understand the information. So I think that is just the human aspect of things. But of course, the business has to make a lot of sense. I think we tend to shift towards a lot of technology companies. I think the world has greatly changed into a technology world. And I think the beautiful thing is that technology can be adopted by many businesses. So the total addressable market is kind of expanding over time. So I think if I want to really summarize how I think about the framework, is really finding good people that wants to make the world a better place and who has this charisma to bring people along to the journey, you know, to make certain things happen. So I think one of the great examples is Toby of Shopify, a great guy, great vision. And I also like platform businesses because today, you know, if you look at Shopify, they are not competing with anyone else, but they're actually enabling a lot of entrepreneurship, right? So that's a great business model, I would say. So management teams, and I look at business. And in terms of valuation, we typically don't use discounted cash flow. I think it's hypersensitive to any changes. But what we really do is price multiples. So we use enterprise value over operating profit as our main measurement of valuation. So I think it's a lot of work that we do. Previously, we were investing in a lot of big names, but currently for the managed account that I'm running, I invest mainly in smaller names.
Got it. Now, one question I have about management and kind of judging people is the great leaders and the great executives, right? The Musks, the Bezos, Toby from Shopify, all these guys, they've got something about them that is unique, that's different, that's, like you said, the charisma that pulls you in. How do you distinguish, I guess, what we can call true charisma or legitimate charisma versus someone that's just trying to play you, in the sense of they're just trying to sell you a story so that you can buy the stock, so that they can fund kind of their phony dreams that aren't really going to come true? Like, have you had an experience in the past where maybe you've fallen for some type of over promotional CEO that met all those characteristics, but was really, you know, there's a witch behind the curtain kind of thing?
Yeah. That's a tough question. I'll try to like unpack it, and hopefully I think this will be something of value. So I can't remember where I read this article, but how do you really differentiate the real rock stars versus the ones that are wannabes? I think it's really looking at their earnings transcripts, right? If they are too focused on the financials, it goes to show that they just want to dazzle the investors, get them excited, and that may not be a good thing. But from my experience interacting with management teams that are really solid ones, what they do often is, you know, the number, there are only three things on their mind. One, the products. How can we create a better product? You know, what else can we create to add more value to our ecosystem, right? To our customers. Second is really the employees. How are my employees feeling right now? And I think third is always the culture as well. So in most cases, when I speak to management teams that tend to really succeed, right, they don't talk so much about the financial numbers, but they are very focused on creating products, how the customers are feeling, and they stay really close to their customers, right? They even do focus groups. They invite their customers to their HQ, you know, just to get feedbacks. So I think at the end of the day, you know, sometimes I do feel that analysts, they are asking the wrong questions. They are asking like, hey, what's your gross margin going to be like in the next quarter? What's your expected growth rate for next year? Whatever it is, right? But I think a more thoughtful question could be asking like, how do you actually plan out your go-to-market strategy? How do you actually decide how much budget allocation for your sales and marketing expenses? Mm-hmm. So I feel that, you know, profits and revenue growth, it's always effect. But what's the cost? The cost is doing a great job. So like, what I would always share with people is something very simple. If you want to have high gross profit margin, well, you have to ask yourself this question. Is this product a valuable product that people is willing to pay? And if you want to have continuous growth rate, does the management have a good strategy, right? So I always try to look at the causes first, right? Instead of looking at the effects. And that's how you can actually tell whether management is really you know, someone that you could really rely on, and someone that tends to be more critical. Not foolproof, but just something a bit from my experience.
It is interesting when you look at earnings calls and you go to the analysts, you know, the questions at the end, everything's introspective in the sense of like, what does this have to do with the business? And it is funny that there are very few, I mean, maybe except for the Costco earnings calls. And maybe that's just because I listened to the Business Blocks with Patrick O'Shaughnessy on Costco today. So maybe that's why it's on the front of my mind. But you very rarely hear an earnings call talk about, hey, how is this going to benefit the customers? Like, how is this going to benefit the end customer? How are you saving money for the customer? How are you providing a better service for the customer? And that in itself might almost be a heuristic and investment filter, where if you can, like, I wonder if you could filter out to see which earnings calls have the most like used times of the word customer. And then to use that almost as an investment filter, because really that's what you should be focused on, is the customer and then your people, like your employees, and then your, you know, all that stuff. And then the shareholder stuff's going to take care of itself if you figure out the other two.
And I say this because, you know, I would say that this one of the underrated resource out there is really Jeff Bezos' annual report. You read that, I could say, you know, that is probably a modern day MBA in itself.
Yeah.
So it's something very worthwhile to read. Yeah. So I always think about him talking about his customers, about adding value. And he said that in the long term, shareholders' interests are always aligned to the customer's interest, to the employee's interest. There's no misalignment at the end of the day.
And it's also like a chicken and the egg question too, because I think Investment Talk on Twitter sent out a tweet a while ago and he said, hey, what's your most controversial take? And I think I tweeted something about how most, you know, every business should focus on customers, then employees, and then shareholders. And I think a lot of people maybe have that reverse, where they see it as like a chicken and the egg. Well, if you focus on the shareholders, then all the other stuff's going to follow. So I do see an argument from both sides, but I think I just think that the ones that focus too much on the shareholders, they miss the big picture, because it's really all about the customer. And if they buy the product, then everyone benefits.
Yeah, I just wanted to share an example. This example was, I think it's a bit an old example. So there's this company called Heinz, the ketchup company.
Yep.
3G came in, wanted to optimize the business, remove benefits from the pantry, cut down on their R&D stuff, remove some administrative stuff as well to just demonstrate higher profits for the next quarter, just to appease investors and probably, you know, to have a higher share price and, you know, higher returns on their own portfolio. So that's really short term, right? Because, you know, I feel that at the end of the day, I would prefer businesses to be managed by founders, because they tend not to listen to the Wall Street analysts. And often in their minds, they know what to do. They know that, you know, today I'm reinvesting my business. It may look bad in the bottom line, but I have the holding power, I have the patience, and my record, right? My legacy is not these few years. It's the long term, it's 10 years, it's measured in decades.
Right.
Whereas for Hyatt management, you know, they do have very, very short-term targets that they have to hit for options. It's just how the incentives are being designed around them. So I do feel that I do not know how to bridge both ends, but I think you know, I tend to have better results investing in founder-led businesses, because they tend to be very mission-focused and purpose-led in all their dealings with their employees, with their suppliers, and in terms of how they grow their business as well.
Whenever I have a good founder-led investment, that when I say good, I mean I bought it for some reasons and then it went up because of the reasons I thought and the founder was awesome, I always wonder why I don't just only buy founder-led businesses. Because I think there's enough out there that you could make a portfolio and find cheap ones all the time if you have a global approach. But I always kick myself. I'm like, why don't I just buy founder-led businesses? Like, why don't I just do that, shrink the universe, and then, you know, try to master that? But, you know, I obviously fail at that. But I do question that every time, because it, you know, it, the alignment's right there.
But I do want to add a few things, because recently I have made a very important distinction. Can a CEO demonstrate a founder-led qualities when he did not found, he did not build a business from scratch? Actually, the answer is yes. There's this guy from Expel, Ryan, right, who's the CEO. And I read an article about him saying that when he saw the business was really in a terrible shape. But what he did was to pay off the company's debts using his own personal cut. You know, just think about it. And also, I think the second point is there's this company called PAR Technology, which is a they are known for their Bring software, point of sale business that's serving names like Starbucks, Arby's, Five Guys, stuff like that. So what he did was, Savneet was a guy that's living his life in New York, very happy, you know, very happy guy. But, you know, his business is located in Cyprus. That's a bit like up north of New York. So he uprooted his whole family and bought, I think rented or bought a house that's in walking distance from the office that he's working in. So when I saw such decisions being made, you know, that's really all in or nothing, right? You got to succeed or yeah, you're just gonna die. I think there's another company called MeterBee, if I pronounce it correctly. I think they are the ones that create ovens. There's this CEO called Sal Lim. What he did was, when he was being appointed as CEO, what he did is he mortgaged his house, got some cash out and bought the shares of the company. So when a CEO goes so deep to the far end,
and he refinances that, just to buy shares.
Exactly, right? As a CEO, right? It's that kind of personal risk that they are putting on the line. And when I look at that, you know, I just think, you know, this guy has to succeed at all costs, right? Because of the decisions that they have made, such as taking out your own credit card to pay off a company's debt, refinance your house to buy shares, or uprooting your whole family, right? And it means moving your kids, moving your wife to a new location. So when I look at that, you know, I think that, hey, sometimes hired management, if they do exhibit and have no such stories, I think for them to succeed in the business, should have a high probability. So one of the questions that I tend to use when I speak to management is, what is a personal sacrifice that you have made while working in a company? That really cuts to the heart of things, right? To really understand,
right?
You know, if there's no personal sacrifice, then I probably think, okay, you know, that is just a normal CEO. But you know, sometimes founder-led CEOs could be lazy too, because they hold too much power, they are not incentivized to run a business properly. So it's really about not just taking it as a rule, but really understanding the context and the scenarios that is being played out in each of the companies.
Right. I want to ask you about emerging moats again, in the sense of trying to understand how companies can ruin them, because a lot of talk is built on, you know, how do you build an emerging moat? How do you see it? How do you recognize it? But I think what's equally as important is understanding when a business, when that moat is eroding and when that's actually collapsing, competition's coming in, it's getting stronger and your defensibilities are down. So are there any heuristics that you use? I mean, it doesn't even have to be quantitative. It could be, like you said, qualitative, like what you see in earnings calls that kind of tip the hat that maybe this emerging moat isn't staying, or it just doesn't have that staying power.
Yeah. Yeah, so before that, I think I would like to describe a little bit about emerging modes for the listeners. So I always think about the world as the cause and effect, right? So then we had to ask ourselves, what does cause and effect have to do anything with businesses? So, but I really think that cause and effects are what drives the world. So, you know, we are very familiar with this term called an economic mode. I think it's being put out by a fund manager called Pat Dorsey. So we learn things like intangible assets, switching costs, network effect, cost advantage, and efficient skill. But I always see those economic modes as the effect of something. So for example, right, one of the best examples that I can share is Facebook, right? How do we identify in the earlier days that Facebook has a strong network effect? It's really using the product to see how intuitive it is, to see how easy it is for people to interact, right? And once you use the product, you understand it, then you realize, hey, you know, a network effect could be probably created from there. You know, we can never say that, hey, you know, we look at this business and we say immediately this business is a network effect. Right? In the earlier days, you cannot see it. But what you need to understand is, you know, learning history and seeing companies that have enjoyed network effects, how were the products being designed? Are they designed intentionally to drive that network effect? So often I look at it and I say, hey, economic modes are always the after effects of things, right? So when we ask ourselves, you know, what are emerging modes, I really think about the fact that we need to look for businesses that has a strong value proposition. They may not be are profitable yet. You know, they keep reinvesting their businesses, reinvesting their money to grow their business even further. You look at a good culture, you look at a capable management. And I think one of the non-negotiable that I always think about is really the intention to build a long-term customer loyalty. So most often I realize that companies that, you know, do not have a clear mode right now that everyone understands, they tend to be the ones that give the highest return, because when things are unknown, when the mode is building, that's where the returns start to compound massively. But when the modes are already established, you know, that could mean that maybe in terms of corporate life cycle, the business could be in a much later stage, right? Maybe towards near maturity or more decline. But where we want to go is really investing in companies where we have the hockey stick, right? The S curve, right? And that's where the modes are currently building. And it may not be very visible, but I think it's really important. So I think if you ask me, what are some ways where we can see that emerging modes are starting to break down? It's really about, I feel that where people no longer care about the business, where people are no longer motivated, where there may be a case where there could be too many projects that they have to do. I think it's a tough question, but I think over time, what I saw in emerging modes that break down is really, it's the people, right? I think it's the culture. In the earlier days, culture is really important, because you're just this young company that's trying to take away lunch from your big competitors. So what you really need to have is very strong execution. And I think that's a non-negotiable. So I think for companies that are considered in the emerging modes, PAL, I tend to want to see new products that's being released quick enough. I want to see them being close to their customers.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because you said something along the lines of, you know, if they're people, if the culture, if the customers stop, you know, really, really becoming fanatical about it. And I remember writing a piece about Cintas Corp, which is the uniform rental business. One of the best businesses of the last couple decades. Incredible, incredible business. But customers honestly don't like them. Like I tweeted out the essay and people commented, they were like, you know, I did business with Cintas and I hated them, but I use them. And it's kind of interesting where I think on one hand, like you're so right in that if you look at the customers and that customer, you know, like super fandom and that fanaticism is kind of gone or it's leaving, I think that's a sign as well as an emerging moat kind of declining, company culture declining. But at the same time, if the business itself is sticky enough, like Spirit Airlines, for example, like everybody hates flying Spirit Airlines. And I think their tagline is, you know, thanks for joining us. If you're a first time, for those of you that said you would never fly with us again, thank you for joining us again. And it kind of just reminds me of, you know, sometimes there's businesses that are so good with what they do with the cost structure and just providing a service that they can get away with not having the happiest customers, which again, just shows you kind of how hard this game is.
Very hot.
It's just, because I would invest in a beautiful business like Spirit Airlines, even though their customer satisfaction. I mean, if you look at their NPS ratings, it's probably I would argue that it's in the negative versus any other business.
Yeah, but I guess you know, I always tell this to a lot of my friends who are just starting out investing or probably have invested for a few years, that we must always recognize the privilege of us being as shareholders. We have so many companies out there in the stock universe for us to choose. And for me, you know, I feel that there are certain things that's non-negotiable. And even though it seemed like the criteria that I set for myself seems to be really high, and I think it is intentionally set that way so that the number of companies get passed through the filter is lesser, but still, fewer, but it's still good enough that, you know, we still have a handful of companies. So I think it's really nice, because in this game, you know, there are many ways to invest, yet, you know, all of us could have very superior results as well.
Do you ever feel tempted to widen your investment filter if you ever get into a period that you aren't finding too many ideas? just to kind of fight the boredom, because I know that that's happened to me where I'll kind of expand my universe because I'm like, wow, I can't really find anything. Like this was probably a few years ago that I struggled with this. And, you know, I just wanted to know maybe if you've had that, you know, for someone that's got a refined focus where maybe you just get bored and you start expanding that filter a little bit.
Yeah. The way I look at it is, you know, Twitter is such a beautiful place. And, you know, I do follow certain people that is incredible. Fred Liu of Hidden Capital, yep. Danny Song of Crosspring Partners.
Yep.
Those guys are incredible. And, you know, I always seem to find really good ideas from people like them and, you know, others, you know, on Twitter. So I have not came to the point that I felt bored with the current process that I have. But earlier on in my investing journey, I've also kind of wandered to the dark side, you know, trying to invest things that I don't understand a little bit. But you know, I think, you know, first, you know, when I lost money the first time, I felt like, okay, maybe, you know, I'm just unlucky, right? The third time, you know, I guess, you know, it's really not for me. So I think it's just because of the experience I went through personally for myself, I have learned to be really, really disciplined about it. And I think what's important as well, if the current names are really giving me the results that I want, and I think the runway is intact, I'll just hold on to the current names. And in fact, on a daily basis, there are a lot more things that I need to learn, to discover, to read about the company. So for example, from the time where I research a company to the point I start to invest in them, I thought I've done a lot of work. But, you know, companies are like living organisms. They evolve, they get better, they get worse. So this concept, I think I kind of read it from Ian Kessel of Microcap Club. They talk about this thing called maintenance due diligence. So I think that alone probably keeps me quite busy, quite occupied. So in my portfolio, I don't hold more than 5 companies. So I spend a lot of time understanding them, speaking to management teams, employees, or maybe day-to-day basis. What I would do is to look at the DEF 14 and maybe find out, or look at Whale Wisdom, right? To find out who are the biggest shareholders. They could be a fund, they could be an individual. Reach out to them, hear from them. What do they like? What do they not like? You know, I would always want to ask, what are the risks about this business that you are seeing right now? Because I think that the saddest thing in this business is that all of us conform to a group thing. So what I think we should always be seeking for is differentiated view. And I think that's where things are more valuable. I think that's a more valuable insight as compared to views that are shared with everyone and there's nothing new under the sun. So that itself, I think, takes a lot of time off my mind and also going on walks to kind of like package it all in my head and really make sense of all the different things that I read throughout the day.
Yeah, and I think it helps to invest in businesses that you truly do have an interest in, because it makes doing that maintenance, you know, maintenance due diligence way easier, where you're actually like, oh, I want to learn about, you know, like whether it's C Limited or PAR or something. You're like, oh, I want to learn about this little piece of their business. Like, oh, I want to learn about this acquisition that they made. You know, because I know sometimes that if you invest in something, like let's just say for valuation's sake, because you think it's cheap, you might not have that inkling to continue to learn about the business because you're just trying to get some few puffs and move on. Where, like you said, you've only got 5 portfolio or 5 companies in your portfolio and you plan on holding them for a long time. So to you, these are exciting businesses that you actually want to continue learning about. You're not just there for a few puffs, you're there for the long ride.
Exactly.
Let's go straight into one of your more recent examples here, Orgenesis. So before we dive in, just for disclosure purposes, I know that we've talked about you know, PAR Technologies and C Limited and now Orgenesis. Are you still a shareholder of all three, or?
Yep, I am. I am a investor in all three.
Okay, cool. Names. All right, so let's dive into Orgenesis now. I have no idea what this company does. It's the first time I've heard of it, so this is kind of exciting. So who are they? What they do? How do you find them? And kind of take us through the thesis.
Yeah, so previously I was invested in this company called Hemacare. So they are in the gene and cell therapy industry, and they got acquired by another company called Charles River. So I realized, okay, I'm having a little bit success investing in the gene and cell therapy industry. And I was just screening across several companies, and I landed on this company called Orgenesis. Back then, they're doing a business called MasterCell, which is a contract development manufacturing organization. So a lot of biotech companies, they need all these clean rooms to manufacture the therapies, the drugs. And Orgenesis does that, right? And, you know, while I was researching about this company, I realized, okay, Orgenesis started to announce something, right? They announced that they are selling MasterCell away to this company called Catalent, because in this industry, they are kind of consolidating everything. So I dropped that company altogether because I realized, oh, okay, if they sold their main business, then what's left, right? So I just dropped that business and I did not invest in it at all. One day, I think I have a friend of mine called Niall from Microcap Club. He actually told me, hey, there's something going on in Orgenesis. You should take a look. So I decided to take a look. And I think just off track a little bit. So I think that's really why we got to have a lot of good friends in this industry to kind of watch for each other, kind of support each other, and kind of like alert to each other about certain interesting developments. All right, so coming back to Orgenesis, then I look at it a little bit deeper and I realized that, you know, what they are doing is really interesting, because today a lot of drugs, when they are being developed, right, for example, you can take out the blood cells from the patients and then ship them over to a centralized location so that the cells could be cultured, could be expanded, could be modified into the drug therapy. Then, you know, you ship back the drug therapy back to the hospital. But, you know, this cold logistics, because blood cells, they die quite quickly. So you got to like freeze them. You got to do a specialized way of handling them, including logistics. There are tremendous costs that's involved. So just think about it. Today, if you would like to cure cancer, right? The current available solutions are easily more than $500,000. So just think about it. Wouldn't it be really sad if a patient would die because he or she doesn't have access to that cancer cure, right? We call it a CAR-T therapy. So I think there's this problem with this industry right now that therapies are too expensive, you know? So what if Orgenesis could be the company to reduce all this drug costs and increase patient affordability? Does that really help the world really help the industry to grow and also help the patients? You bet, right? I think definitely 100%. So what they do is that instead of a centralized clean room manufacturing, they have decentralized the whole process, right? Just think about your containers, right? We call it, what Orgenesis call it is the Orgenesis mobile processing units and labs. So in short, we call it the OnPill. So every hospital right now, you could actually have an OnPill, and it's an automated process. So in terms of the people that you need, a technician that you need, you only need two. So your cost is actually lower. And you know, you don't have to ship the cells to a separate location. Sometimes it could be a different country as well, and ship it back. So if you look at it, you know, the cost to actually ship a product from one place to another is 20% of the drug cost. A lab technician could also cost up to 20% of the drug cost as well. And sometimes because of lack of quality check, and then certain batch production would fail, and that actually adds up to the cost as well. So what Orgenesis is doing, I think, is changing the game. I think it's not well understood by a lot of people right now. What's the strategy? What they are doing? I think the unit economics are not very clear. This is why I think it is an opportunity. And also, they have actually put forward, I think, several years of R&D into last year. So, you know, I think people look at the profit and loss statement and they were really scared. And they thought that, hey, this business is probably going to bankrupt. But what they do not know is what is happening in reality on the ground. A lot of work is being done. And on top of that, they also have a pipeline of therapies. Some of them are already commercialized, just waiting to be waiting to scale and waiting to earn more revenues. So, you know, if I could summarize the whole thesis of how I look at opportunities, you know, number one, if you look at a business on just a superficial level, you think that, hey, the business is going to be bankrupt and it's being priced as a business that's going to bankrupt. Second, I think that business is reinvesting heavily, and I think the normalized margins are being suppressed. And I think, in short, I think the profitability is also being masked because of the accelerated spending. So I'd like to draw this analogy to another company called ClearPoint Neuro. I think ClearPoint Neuro is another company that I own. And I saw similar pattern recognition because in the earlier days, a lot of people could not understand the technology. They were loss making as well. But as it gets proven over time, you know, you get a multiple re-rating, you got earnings growth. And I think from a $4 share price now is about $20. So I think there's a lot of knowledge gap between the market and what Origitis is really doing. And I think I'm very patient in this name. And I think they're executing on many fronts. The Onpills is scaling up. So I'm just waiting for one day for the market to recognize the value that they're doing. So in terms of why I look at this business and I think it will work out well, it's really understanding where does the validation come from, right? You can say that, you know, you can do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, but how is this valuable and how is this validated? So if I look at some of the hospitals that I'm working with is John Hopkins, I think UC Davis as well, and some of the really reputable hospitals in Israel and Greece as well. So that really goes to show that, and there are interviews being done as well. So to really show that, hey, this technology is being proven. But I think what the company needs to work on is really doing good press release and improving their branding, because these people are all scientists, right? They are not marketers. They do not know how to market their package their company better. While being a listed company, I think packaging and communicating your strategy is really important. And that is also perhaps another reason why the company is mispriced right now.
Now, how do you wrap around this company from a circle of competence perspective, right? Because if I look at ORGS and if I'm just some, you know, layman like I am going through and I see, oh, it's a health technology biotech stock, immediately I'm 8 out of 10, like, nope, not going to look at it. So, and that's probably a, just a detriment to my style that I actually should work on. How do you determine, like, let's say within this space, right? How do you determine whether something is inside your circle of competence? Like, do you have some sort of, you know, medical biotechnology background, or is it more of, you know, hey, find a niche inside of this, what looks like a complex industry, find a niche inside of it that I can understand? Because that's how I would kind of frame it, where it's like, what's something simple that even my brain could understand?
Yeah, that's really great. So I'm going to reveal some secrets that I usually do for these companies. Yeah. So number one, Origenesis had a business called MasterCell, which the CEO, Barrett Kaplan, which is still running Origenesis today, have grown the business from $3 million revenue to $33 million in revenue. So that's kind of like 10 to 11x the revenue. And she sold off the business, got a pile of money. Yep. And she took the money and reinvest back to building these decentralized clean rooms. So this lady, Verrett, is already a proven operator, right? She has proven that she could grow a business from $3 million to $33 million. And you would think that someone like her you know, would take the proceeds and maybe do something safer. But yeah, she took the money and built something that's not heard of before. Maybe there's some conviction that she has, but I really believe that the biggest returns from investing is really betting on visionaries. So that's one element of it. The management teams, have they had success before doing different things, and what were the level of success that they enjoyed? Second is always the people as well that they can attract as well. So I think in CFA level one, we have learned this concept called the Mosaic theory. So we, like, let's say for example, if I share with you this guy weighs about 100 kg and this guy is about 150 cm short. So can I ask you if this guy is fat or thin? Well, the answer that you can give to me is fat, right? We don't need a measuring scale to tell that. So what I also try to implement in my investing concept is this idea of Mosaic theory. So I look at the people, are they proven? What are the chances that they are that they could succeed? And second, it's the quality of people that they are attracting as well. So while this company, you look at it, the market cap is really small, but if I go LinkedIn and I really search the kind of people that they have, the board of directors, the kind of talent that they're attracting, some of these talents you could only find in bigger companies, but yet they chose to be scientific advisory board of Orgenesis. They chose to be board of directors of mm-hmm. Orgenesis. And I look at a medical director, is this guy called Heiko. And Heiko is a guy that is very reputable, and he's actually married to the president of EC, right? That means this guy who's the medical director, his wife is a president of the European Commission. And this is just one example of the talent that he's that Orgenesis is able to attract. And you see, I just think about it. If in a company, Orgenesis, there's nothing really fancy, you know, the chances of succeeding is really, really low. Why would someone like Heiko, who has such strong reputation and certain career that he has built, risk his whole life and join Orgenesis as a medical director? So I would like to see who are the people that are actually taking a risk on the business. And when I look at the whole thing, I try to triangulate and try to ask myself, hey, you know, does it tilt the success rate to be a bit higher? So I'm always looking at all these telltale signs, the quality of people that they're attracting, the kind of customers they are attracting, and also the track record of the current management team. But of course, I do my best to understand the science a little bit more. And I think just speaking to their partners and asking them about how is Orgenesis doing, you know, why do you decide to partner with Orgenesis? So again, I do not know how exactly the science works, but what I do know is really piecing information together and making some sense out of it.
Yep, exactly. So, I mean, I love ideas like that where they're involved in industries from right off the bat. They're going to be ignored by a lot of people just because it says biotech. I want to pivot now to investing on a broader sense, kind of, across the globe and specifically in Asia versus the US, just because you have an interesting perspective being in Singapore, which, you know, a lot of people, and I think to a lot of, stateside residents here, Singapore is kind of that destination that everyone wants to go to because it's like the perfect economy. It's capitalism done perfectly. I just think of it as like this utopia where businesses thrive and the economy is thriving. Maybe it's just because Jim Rogers always talks about how much he loves living in Singapore. And that's kind of marred my view on it. But what are some differences? Maybe at like the kind of like what you said, like the company culture, or even just like the demographic culture when it comes to investing in Asian companies versus US-based companies. Like what are some idiosyncratic traits about Asian businesses that maybe a lot of US investors like myself miss when judging these things?
Yeah. So I would say Singapore is a great country. I enjoy living here. There are a lot of great cuisines, and you know, if any of your listeners would love to come to Singapore, one day I would love to bring you around to the best places, not the tourist traps, but the real good food. All right. You may be a bit disappointed to hear this, but investing in Singapore is not really exciting. It's not really fun. There's nothing to really talk about. Partially because we are a small country, and the early companies that were established that remains dominant today are mostly government-linked companies, like your telcos, like your banks, like your property developer. Okay. But we do have some innovators that are growing as well.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, I do feel that, in comparison with the CEOs that we see, the quality of CEOs that we see overseas, I think Singapore, the CEOs in Singapore pale in some comparisons. For example, in terms of shareholders' rights, today you try to be activist in Singapore and see what kind of success you get. I don't think you'll get a lot of success. I think if you want to question the management team, you have to think twice. Or maybe you could try, but maybe you will not get the answers that you want as compared to CEOs that we see in America. I think in Singapore as well, we do not have, you know, this is something that I hope that will change over time as well, but we don't really have a lot of visionaries. Why is that so? Because, you know, in Singapore, if you are being born here, we have a great education system. Everything is somehow being predetermined. The kind of education you go, the path that you go, it's a very safe route. When it's a very safe route, you know, it doesn't encourage risk-taking. It does not encourage entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, the current government is doing a lot to change the whole mentality. So, which goes back to the idea that, you know, for any entrepreneurs, once they succeed, they make enough money, they tend to stop running their business after a while. They are very easily satisfied. They do not have the hunger to kind of change the world with their products. But, you know, just to be fair, I think we have a handful of great entrepreneurs, visionaries, but, you know, personally, I wish that we have more. But in America, you know, we have great names like Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Steve Jobs, you know, so there are so many names that I could name off. But in Singapore, we just don't have enough. So I feel that I wish that I've invested in America, American companies much earlier, because I feel that the management teams over there tends to be hungrier, tends to be more passionate, and tends to be more long-term as well. Just one thing to mention about, I think, Singapore companies, there might be a lot of related party transactions. And it's very common to see that a listed company management hires their own family members, relatives to run the business together. And sometimes when it comes to performance review, they may not be able to draw the line. And you wonder, why is a particular a relative earning so much money? And how do you actually appraise the performance at all? You know, so those are the things that I hope that, you know, we can improve. But apart from, you know, the stock market that we have in Singapore, the country is safe. I think we have a lot of good food. I think there are a lot of people who see it as a very safe country because of the stable politics. I think we have Ray Dalio, who is setting up the family office here. We have a lot of American CEOs trying to establish their family offices here. So I think in the next few years, in terms of us as a financial hub, I think it will do well.
Yeah, no, it's always interesting. I spent some time last year diving into the Japanese markets and the Mothers Index in there. Yeah. And I think Teddy, I don't know his last name on Twitter, but I want to say it's like Okama or something. Do you know who I'm talking about? Here, let me look it up. Teddy, because I don't want to butcher his name on here. Okay, well, I'm looking at his name, and I'm still gonna butcher the pronunciation. It's Teddy Okuyama. So he runs, So he runs TeddyOkuyama.substack.com. It'd be cool to get him on the podcast too. But basically, the Japanese markets kind of had the similar issue where in Japan, a lot of it's seniority ranked based in terms of corporate. So no matter if you're a bright young eyed person, seniority matters really above all else. So it's almost impossible for younger people that have ideas to kind of move up the corporate ladder. And in Japan, it is way more established to find the job at one company and work at that one company for the rest of your life. Because Japanese companies really, really, really do take care of their people. Like I think, I don't know if I read this in an article, but during Corona, like a lot of Japanese businesses, they didn't cut anybody. They didn't fire anybody, which is really, really a testament. But like in the Japanese Mothers Index, what was interesting about the entrepreneur scene there is that there was this one guy that was almost like the Mark Zuckerberg of Japan. And I forget his name, but he got like arrested and like some crazy thing. He was doing drugs, betting on horses and all that stuff. And that one bad apple, I guess if you want to say, kind of marred and kind of distorted the image of like a Japanese entrepreneur. And people, you know, were like, oh, you want to be an an entrepreneur, you're going to be like this guy. So I think it's only a matter of time though, because what you're seeing in the mother's market and coming out of Japan is just an influx of tremendous technology businesses. And I think that's just going to cascade toward other Asian-based nations, as they kind of adopt, you know, that risk on mentality.
Yeah, and I think in a way how we do education as well, it's kind of changing the game a little bit. For example, as early as, let's say, you are 13 years old, 14 years old, during your school holidays, instead of having school assignments during school holidays, now they're changing the curriculum a little bit. So coming August, I will have two person who I think they are just 15, 16 years old. They're coming to kind of intern
awesome.
Our youngest analyst, to kind of have the experience, to kind of have that the drive as well. And I think a lot of job attachments to small companies, startups, so that they get a hang of it, you know, to understand how the startup scene work a little bit. The government is trying to change that. So we'll see how it goes in the next few years.
I think it's interesting you bring up these younger aged interns, and there was a quote from Bill Gurley and talking about, you know, venture investing and kind of what he loves about it. And, you know, he mentioned that, you know, he's always surrounded himself with like younger people, and it's a young man's game. And I really do think that as much as, you know, you've got people like Buffett and all these old sages and, you know, wisdom out the wazoo, there is something to be said about surrounding yourself with young people that know how to build a good company, or know what trends are, know what's popular, know what the consumers are using. They may not be the best investor, but honestly, some of those things can be incredible signals, especially as you get older and you kind of get out of touch. Like, for instance, Roblox, I think, is a perfect example where you've got parents that are buying shares just to hedge the in-app purchases that they spend on their kids.
I think that's so true. You hit a point, right? I always want to have young people in my company, because even though this year is 2021, I'm 29 years old, but there are a lot of things I discovered that I do not know right now. So I don't know why I feel a bit old, but I think when I have young people, during COVID-19, and also because of TikTok, there's a lot more information out there on YouTube as well about investing. But I do see that the young people these days are really smart people. They are able to find for information faster, and they are able to learn quicker. They know how to piece information together as well. And I always believe that, you know, the future belongs to the young ones, because they will be the future consumers of tomorrow. So understanding how they think, understand what are purchasing habits, and how do they purchase things as well, I think it's going to be really crucial in terms of our investment success. So I think in terms of the investment team, sometimes we want to have young people in our team so that, you know, they give us a different opinion. I always kind of tell my whole team, you know, let's not have group thing. And if you feel like saying something, even if it's unpopular, just say it. Yeah. You know, I don't want you to bury your opinions because you think you're the youngest here. There's no such thing. You know, if we want to succeed, then we got to find the truth. And finding the truth is by having your views being expressed, you know, everyone in the team.
Yeah. And I think investing's particularly challenging because everybody talks about diversity of thought. And most of the time when you hear that, it's, you know, diversity of race, gender, background, and stuff like that. But not often do you hear age as a diversification, because investing is one of the few endeavors where you're actually penalized for how young you are. In terms of just kind of your opinion, I think the internet's doing a better job of changing that with giving creators a platform to kind of speak about what they know. But it is interesting how that's kind of the one playground where you're almost penalized for being, you know, too young, which is interesting because, like, in sports, you want the youngest people, you want the fastest athletes. You know, in a lot of creatives, you're always searching for the young, but in investing, it's like, oh, you're young, you don't know anything, you gotta wait.
Yeah, I think you made me think a lot, you made me reflect a lot as well. And I hope I'm not offending a lot of people by saying this.
I mean, if you are, who cares, right? It's my podcast, so they'll just get mad at me.
there's a lot of upside with, you know, getting younger people on your team because number one, they have longer runways. They are able to absorb work faster, and you know, suppose you know you have a strong, solid culture, they will stay on. This could be their first job and last job because they are just going to work for you for the rest of their lives. And when they accumulate the knowledge, the know-how, and they are able to pass it down to your future team members as well. And I think that's one thing. And second thing is some of us may have gone through MBA, some of us has gone through summer internship program by big banks like JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, or whatever, right? But I do think that in some cases, it could be excessive in terms of the financial modeling. Mm. And at the end of the day, does it really work? You know, if you have more numbers on your financial sheet, does that make you a better investor? Does it help you to evaluate company a lot better? Maybe not, right? So if I want to strip away like all the education that we have gone through in terms of how we analyze company in a school manner, I would say the best way for the younger ones to learn is always, hey, you know, why not just shadow a company for a day? Why not really understand what a business truly is? A business is not just numbers, but because what we're always told is that it's all about numbers, right, in a financial world. But what if you go down to understand a person's passion, ambition, the reason why they want to start this company, where do they want to bring this forward? How do they market and why is their marketing strategy different from the rest? And ask this management, you know, what kind of profitability margins do they hope to achieve by pricing a product in a certain way? It's really just understanding business without that package way to learn in a certain manner, right? That's why I feel like learning could be in so many different directions and you can have a better outcome not following a rigid or a structured way. But of course, this is not for everyone. You know, some people, when you learn this way, it's a bit chaotic. There's no structure. Some people may not thrive. But I think there are many ways to learn. And I think sometimes by learning it in a different way, you have a better outcome and that could make you even a better investor.
Yeah. And all of this is made possible by the tremendous mentees and business owners that do take that risk and bring on a younger person. That's where I am. You know, I'm here talking to you because I had a first boss in this business that took me as just some random college junior from a school that isn't an Ivy League, didn't do any MBA. And he had his door open and he would give me projects and he would say, I want you to find an idea and I want you to write it and bring it to me. And he would sit there and he would listen and he would give me feedback. And that means more to someone at that age than you could ever know. And so, I just think it's very important. And, you know, obviously this wasn't even in the outline. So that's kind of funny how that turned out. But you know, it is 10:15 right now PM for me. I know you're just getting your day started. Mine is fast coming to an end. My bed is calling me. So I'm gonna wrap it up with just kind of our closing questions here. So where can people go to find out more about you? I know you're on Twitter. Are there any other places that people can look?
All right. So people could look me at Twitter, the Slingshot Cap, short form. So Slingshot CAP Cap. I'm mostly over there. And in my bio, you can actually see my email. If there's anything I could add in terms of value, in terms of other knowledge or exchange of investment ideas, do reach out to me. So that's how you can reach me. And once again, my doors are always open. If any of your listeners or Brandon, you yourself, you come to Singapore, please let me host you to bring you around Singapore.
I'm definitely going to take you up on that. I can't wait. Singapore is a place that I've really wanted to go for a while. So I gotta get that on the schedule. And then the final question, if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
That's really a tough question because why? I don't mean to be arrogant when I think about it this way, but I feel like in this investing world, we seem to idolize people like Jeff Bezos, like Warren Buffett, you know, the likes of the legend, right? Joe Greenblatt or anyone. But what I really kind of reflected and think about it, it's like, you know, there are so many things that I can learn from everyone. And every day I'm learning, right? Every day I try to use Twitter to the best of my I try to make use of Twitter in a best way by creating a list where I put all the people that I really think that provide high quality content. And you know, I could be just speaking to a nobody, right? Maybe on Twitter, someone that has only like less than 50 followers, but this guy has great intellect. So if you really ask me, I don't have a very strong desire to say, hey, I want to go on dinner with a particular person. But I just think that life is so wonderful, is that, you know, there are just new ways to think. And I think Twitter is just like everyone coming together, sharing their ideas, trying to be better than yesterday. And I think I don't really have an answer to that, but I guess I just wanted to say that, you know, just learn, just contribute. And I think just try to be a valuable person, because I think if you are a valuable person, you attract the people who are similar kind of people. And, you know, at the end of the day, you design an environment whereby you grow very, very well at the end of the day. That's what I really believe in.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's a great way to kind of end this show. There's so many people out there, and it's kind of funny. I mean, I've got a follower number that kind of blows my mind. Like, why would this many people choose to follow me and kind of monitor the post list or the mindless dribble that I talk to? And then I'll reach out to some anonymous account on there that's like some crazy, like, amazing investor that's had this long track record, and he's, you know, he's just sitting here, he's like, yeah, I've got a, you know, a few hundred followers, a couple thousand followers, and this dude's like a legend that you would pay, you know, $500 an hour at lunch with. And, you know, like, you know, case in point, like Ho Nam, who's on Twitter, he just joined from Altos Capital, I think, and he had like a couple thousand followers, and I shot him like a DM once. And, you know, from the time that we DM'd to the time that we got on the phone, he went from 2,000 to like 13,000 followers. And I'm like, there's people all over like that, that just hop on Twitter that have so much knowledge, which just makes it so exciting. So, you know, again, this is how we got connected. So, Kelvin, this was so much fun. I can't wait to post this in, 8 hours? I think I'm going to go to bed now. But I will get in touch with you soon about that Singapore trip, because I want to make it happen, and we'll record it and we'll share it with everybody, and it'd be super fun. We can eat some good food and talk investing. So thanks so much for coming on the show, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
Thank you, Brandon. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.